welcome to a new episode of the Digging a Hole podcast. On this podcast, David Schleicher, me, and my co-host Sam Moyne talk about legal theory. And we're super excited for this episode because it's a big event. So what's going on, Sam?
Well, I think there was a national election, David, and you know,
was there? I missed it.
I know you don't follow the news, but I do, and you know, at least the Twitter refraction of it. And the good news is that, you know, as everyone begins with their recriminations over whether their priors were vindicated by the election outcomes, which of course they
mine
were
100%.
Of course,
yeah, 100%.
No. It's amazing that no one's weren't, and it seems like it's an amazing election that can universally confirm what everyone already thought. But actually, maybe not, because we have this opportunity this time. The Harvard Law Review commissions, as it does every year, a foreword to its volume. And Michael Klarman wrote it. And it's an extraordinary piece in volume as well as in content. And I think it's an opportunity because it makes some claims about our current political system that, you know, the election, you know, tests. And along with Mike, an old colleague of mine, we have Amna Akbar, who's a younger scholar who's become very prominent and influential, who wrote at the Law Review's request a response to Mike's piece. And so we'll be considering this work of scholarship and, you know, how it relates to the, you know, the bleeding edge of the present.
It is rare that you get a piece that is like so on point with the moment of recording. So it's not only the piece being being released soon, it will have been released by the time you all listen to this, but also it's like it's about the election, give or take, and about the things that led to the election. So with that, let's get into it. So terrific.
So on the podcast today, we have two fantastic guests. Amna Akbar is an associate professor at Ohio State University Law School, where she's made a name for herself doing very high profile scholarship and on abolitionism and other things. Our other guest is Mike Klarman, who's a longstanding now professor at Harvard Law School, one of the leading legal academics of our time, and best known for his historical scholarship. But today we're going to be discussing his brand new epic, Harvard Law Review Foreword, which is entitled The Degradation of American Democracy and the Court, to which Amna has responded also in the Harvard Law Review. And so we're going to begin by welcoming both our guests. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So just to kick us off, Mike, would you provide a summary of what you tried to do? I think it's one of the longest articles that I've ever read, and yet it's incredibly gripping, and it brings us up to the bleeding edge of the present, and it provides a certain diagnosis of the situation, let's call it. And
I think it's the longest Law Review article of all time. Is that accurate? I think it's the single longest law review article
there
of all time. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm you know, I think if it's not, it's in the top five. So congratulations.
I think it's certainly the longest foreword in this now classic genre that's been going on for decades. And so, Mike, would you just, you know, tell us what you said in those many gripping words?
Sure. I think the Law Review kids told me it was twice as long as any other foreword, and that's after they cut it by 20%, but they also added a ton back because of their obsession with footnoting everything, which we're all familiar with. So I tried to, in the first part, describe what's going on in the United States, the declining democracy rating from Freedom House. I started by setting a baseline of what's going on in the world in places like Hungary and Poland, the Philippines and Turkey, looking at what I called the autocratic playbook. And I talked about Trump's openly autocratic bent. Most of this is probably familiar to listeners, but things like attacking independent judges, attacking the media, undermining transparency in government, pathological lying, racism, cozying up the foreign autocrats. Part 1C is about the Republican Party's assault on democracy, which I think is less well known. Here we're talking about things like voter ID laws, partisan gerrymandering, undermining the power of governors once Democrats take control of the governorship, making it difficult to pass referenda, so forth and so on. And then the last section of part one was the Republican Party's complicity with Trump, which I think you see just since the election with senators like Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz just almost unbelievably backing the president's claims that are based on no evidence, just outright lies about stealing the election. Then I tried to explain why this is happening, which to me was the most interesting part, because I think I went into the project without being able to give you a clear idea why this is happening. And a lot of it has to do with race, changing demographics, changing birth rates that are making the United States gradually a non-white majority country. Some of it has to do with the secularization of the population, religious groups, religious conservatives feeling as if they're losing a world in which the United States was unofficially a Christian nation. Some other factors as well. I don't want to go on too long. And then the court's complicity. So the court's willingness to uphold voter purges and voter ID laws, the court's gutting of any kind of campaign finance reform, the court's refusal to get involved with partisan gerrymandering. And then finally, a little bit about the prognosis, what's likely to happen next, what's the best remedy for this situation. The United States has become a pervasively minority rule system based on gerrymandering and especially geographic sorting in the House and state legislatures, the massive malapportionment of the Senate, which is going to keep Democrats from controlling the national government right now. And then the Electoral College, which is a fiasco. Joe Biden's likely to have won the election by at least 4 or 5%, which is, you know, 7 or 8 million votes by the end of the counting. That's not even that close an election, and yet he's barely going to win re-election. So, you know, we need to entrench democracy and make the system more majoritarian, but the Supreme Court is a clear and present threat to that because they may very well strike down any sort of democracy entrenching legislation. If the Democrats had taken control of the Senate, they should have seriously considered the possibility of expanding the size of the court or some other sort of reform, as you have written about, Sam.
So I'm generally on board, obviously, with the whole picture you lay out and some of the kinds of remedies for the horrendous Supreme Court jurisprudence we've seen in recent decades. Still, I want to begin by asking you about how you frame what the problem is. In a way, in spite of like the amazingly comprehensive depiction of the current syndrome, things that may get marginalized as a result of the focus you choose. And I guess the, you know, kind of snarky way I'd put this is that at times the foreword reads like an amazing, somewhat, you know, long MSNBC episode. It's focused very intently, first and foremost, on Donald Trump as a person and as an actor. And also, of course, on the Republican Party. That's all very persuasive. I'm not suggesting that those shouldn't have been at the focus. But I want to ask about, you know, especially when you come to kind of the explanatory side, other ways of thinking, you know, let's say about the political foundations of how this could come about and about economics. This is going to kind of reprise, like, you know, intra-liberal or left liberal disputes we've been having around, you know, the last 4 years for a while. But I think they're pertinent right now. So first, it's quite interesting that when it comes to the court, you talk about the interpretation of the Constitution, not the Constitution. Just now, you've I think rightly, you know, commented on the Electoral College, but we could add other institutions of minority rule like the Senate, judicial review, and so forth. And you know, the funny thing is that your I think most recently published book, this is book length, but your most recently published book is about oligarchy and the makings of the Constitution, the framers' coup, which I'm sure all of our listeners know about. And so on the political side, I just want to hear more about why it is that in the foreground, we get Trump and the Republicans and not a broader systemic account of minority rule that the Republicans then exploited. On the economic side, you have an amazing brief section about inequality and then a longer one about what you call radical Ayn Rand ideology. And what I'm wondering, is that the same as what Amna in her response calls neoliberalism? Because, you know, from out on the left, it looks like the Ayn Rand thing, radical libertarianism, is one part of a much broader commitment, which included the Democratic Party for decades to economic liberalism of various kinds. And I guess I got worried by the end, in spite of nodding the whole way, that there's like scapegoating of Trump and the Republicans at the expense of a much broader syndrome commitment to neoliberalism. And I just want to get at whether that's fair or whether the focus is right, whether there's a broader lens that we need, or and whether you're contributing kind of a piece of it, or the, you know, whether things kind of are getting pushed so far to the margins that, you know, we might start to get worried about the kind of intensity of the focus in the first place.
It's a really interesting point. And I think if I were writing a autobiography or history of the foreword, the answer is it evolved over 4 years from giving talks before the 2000 election, and then for the last 4 years since then, about Trump and his threat, and the threat he poses to democracy. So the autocratic playbook, and how much Trump, who we know doesn't actually read books, but seems to have a really firm, intuitive grasp on how to exercise power in an authoritarian way. So that's where this came from. And as I already said, you know, the stuff in part two was interesting to me because I learned a lot about how we've gotten to this point, not only that we could elect somebody who was so openly authoritarian, but that the Republican Party would basically just fall in line. And now 47% of Americans, you know, 70 million people are going to have voted for a second term for somebody who obviously doesn't believe in democracy. So, Let me say some stuff about the economics and say some stuff about the minority rule. I was just reading the piece that you co-wrote about different ways in which to do court reform. And one of the things that you focus on there is kind of the counter-majoritarian threat that courts pose. And, you know, traditionally, I think I would have agreed with that, but our system of politics has become so anti-majoritarian that I'm not really sure that judicial review contributes very much to it, right? It's perfectly plausible to believe on a lot of issues that the Supreme Court could be more majoritarian than a national politics that won't support gun control, that 90% of Americans support or won't support environmental regulation that 70 to 80% of Americans agree with, or immigration reform that 70 to 80% agree with. It's true that this is an incredibly right-wing court, the most conservative in 100 years. And when they do things like Citizens United, they're probably frustrating the preferences of 80% of Americans, both Republicans and Democrats. But the system, you know, the problem is probably not the court's counter-majoritarianism. The problem is that the politics is broken and systematically anti-majoritarian. And that's because the Republican Party can hold on to power, losing a majority of votes, both in the House and in the Senate and in the presidency. And then all the campaign finance devastation that the court has wreaked, so that ordinary Americans no longer have any political influence, as Page and Gillens have shown. As you said, part two has a short section on inequality, and I do think inequality is a huge issue, but we need to remember that, you know, people who are suffering from the economy, who are racially resentful, vote for Trump, and people who are suffering from the economy and are not racially resentful vote for Bernie Sanders. So this is never just going to be about economic inequality. It's also about tremendous increases in racial resentment and their concentration in the Republican Party. And that, after all, is what predicted votes for Trump in the Republican primaries in 2016. So the economic inequality is a factor, but it needs to be ignited by something else. The neoliberalism, I haven't read the Omni piece yet. I haven't, Laurie didn't show it to me, so I haven't read that yet. My guess is we're talking about something similar when we talk about neoliberalism and neo-Ayn Randians. I'm talking about an extreme libertarian view that in the 1960s would have been associated with somebody like Milton Friedman, represented by Barry Goldwater, thoroughly repudiated in the 1964 election, then made a comeback in the 1970s, following the outline of the famous Powell Memorandum and for the Chamber of Commerce in 1971, financed by conservative billionaires like the Koch brothers, the Bradley Foundation, later by the Mercers, leading to the creation of think tanks like the Cato and Heritage, and then represented in politics by the Reagan administration, taking over the Republican Party, a radical anti-tax agenda set forward by Grover Norquist in the mid-1980s, a radical anti-environmental agenda, but also, you know, taken to an extreme by someone like Paul Ryan, who says that providing poor school kids with a free lunch may be good for their stomach, but bad for their soul. Or Tom Tillis, who said that as long as a restaurant posts a sign saying we don't require our employees to wash their hands, they should have satisfied any health and safety regulations because then people are free to make a choice. Or the governor of North Dakota, who said within the last week that dealing with the pandemic is not a problem for government. It's not just an issue for government. So basically, you know, herd immunity or die. So that's what I'm talking about. Now, it's true Democrats got seduced by that, and that's a fair criticism that Bill Clinton is appointing Treasury secretaries from Wall Street and Barack Obama is listening to advice from the same sorts of people. But I think that misses something pretty important, which is the Democratic Party was on a path never to win presidential elections again, because we were in an era where we were transitioning from a country that was literally 90% white, where 90% of the voters for both the Democratic and Republican Party in the 1950s were white, to a country that by 1980 was only 80% white and today is less than 60% white. And the Republicans had figured out a formula to win landslides. So, you know, every election, from 1972 to 1988 was a Republican landslide, except for Jimmy Carter, who, you know, was a pretty good Democratic nominee because he's a Southern born-again Christian. And of course, the Republicans suffered from Watergate. So I just think it's really important not to forget. I can just remember vividly in 1988 thinking the Democrats would never win another presidential election. And that changed because they triangulated and because Bill Clinton said the era of big government is over and he did welfare reform. And you know, remember, the Republicans were scoring points on late-term abortion, on gay marriage, which was starting to bubble up through Hawaii. And so, yeah, the Democrats were more influenced by the neo-Ayn Randism than they should have been. But it's also the case that the new and not better Republican Party had figured out how to win white evangelicals and anybody who was racially resentful. And that was a pretty powerful coalition until the country started to change in some pretty fundamental ways, which have now probably created, right, the Obama coalition, which, you know, going forward is going to be a winning coalition, but you've still got this problem that you need to deal with. With the structural deficits in the American political system and Republican voter suppression. And I think the way to do that is, I'm with you on this, Sam, the way to deal with that is not to become less progressive in your economic formula, which I think it's some of the Democratic congressional representatives who won Republican districts think that's the lesson they've already taken away. The Abigail Spanbergers have taken that lesson. I think that's the wrong lesson. There's no reason to think that you're going to lose lots of votes by embracing you know, public option for healthcare or doing something massive about the environment and taxing wealthy people. I do not believe that's the way to go.
So I definitely don't disagree with you there. And I, what you said was broadly very persuasive. Let me ask about the very interesting passage towards the end where you say, if Joe Biden wins, I'll be accused of Trump derangement syndrome. Well, we know basically he won. You say that you'll get that accusation if he wins by a lot, and we can debate how much, how big a victory it was. But just could you give us your take on whether the election results as we know them as of this podcast bolster or undermine your kind of general picture in the forward?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. I've been thinking a lot about that as I was walking on the beach up in Maine this morning. I was listening to Michelle Goldberg talk about her reaction. This is the podcast she does with Ross Douthat in the Times. The election result is horrifying in a way. It's deeply disappointing, but I mean that differently from horrifying. I think most of us had adjusted our baseline and assumed that Democrats were going to take the Senate. And Nate Silver told us, 78% chance they were going to take the Senate. And that meant that if Biden wanted to be, he could be FDR in the first 100 days and he could pass, some version of climate change and infrastructure legislation, a massive coronavirus relief bill, do something about, expanding healthcare. I mean, he could do all that and just ram it right through. And you might have to deal with the Supreme Court. So I think one of those bills would be a democracy entrenching and court expansion. This is horrifying. I mean, 47% of the American people have voted for somebody whose response to the coronavirus pandemic literally is responsible for killing tens of thousands of Americans. We now have 120,000 people in a day getting sick, and the administration's response is herd immunity, which is going to kill thousands of more Americans and make hundreds of thousands of them, millions of them sick. And at the same time, they're trying to cut healthcare. And now, having had COVID is probably a pre-existing condition. They lie about that. The president, on a daily basis is attacking democracy. I mean, in the months leading up to the election, he said, I'm not going to commit to a peaceful transition. I'm not going to condemn white supremacy. He was daily calling for his political adversaries to be incarcerated and so forth and so on, right? He refused to hold the Russians to account for providing bounties on American soldiers. He called American soldiers suckers and losers. I mean, and 47% of the country, at least maybe 48%, voted for him. That's going to end up being 65 to 70 million Americans voted for him. That just shows you we are in a terrible situation. We are lined up as teams and almost nobody is persuadable based on any fact or any transgression that you can think of. So, 75% of Republicans think Trump has done a great job with regard to the coronavirus, and most of them don't believe climate change is real, and they don't believe anything the media says. God knows how risky it is that they may not believe that Trump really lost the election. It's likely to be called today in favor of Biden. We are in a terrible, terrible situation, and the fact that you already see Republican senators, right? Trump Jr. said, where are all the 2024 hopefuls? Why are they not lining up behind the White House? And immediately, Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham go on television and support the president's preposterous lies that this is being stolen from him, because they now realize that that's the path forward for the Republican Party. So, we're going to be in for worse, not better. And the next set of authoritarians will be a little bit more intelligent and a little bit more skillful and a little bit more openly racist and misogynist. So, you're going to have to deal with this for a long time. And I don't really see how this ends anytime soon. You're not going to convert people. These are teams. It's like Yankees fans and Red Sox fans. And if your guy committed a transgression, you're going to figure out some way to excuse it.
This actually picks up where I wanted to ask you about, which is I couldn't, given the kind of kitchen sink nature of the article, which kind of reprises, all of the kind of greatest hits of the 2016 to 2020 kind of left of center, but you know, you're maybe 1,000 sites from everything from how democracies died, Ezra Klein's book, and all of this stuff. I wonder, do you think there's any place or any what? I mean, ask this differently. What would a non-authoritarian conservative politics look like to you? Or is there such a thing? Or do you accept the legitimacy of a right of center politics in America? Because it kind of felt like you kind of went across the board and described the entirety of the right of center political program, from tax cuts to voter purges, from stealing and, you know, emoluments to immigration policy to environment, as all part of one broad quasi-authoritarian or proto-authoritarian project. And there's a reason to do this, which is you kind of say these things are politically entrenching. But of course, all policies are politically entrenching. You know, famously, Social Security is designed to be politically entrenching. And so, this seems to me to be a very large question, because it is, in fact, the case that the Republican Party is one of the most distinctive things about American politics, making it different from other places. But I'm a little unclear, given, like, the breadth of your critique, like, what is there a space for anything other than kind of, is the answer to this to vote for Democrats, or is there some other line here?
Well, you know, it's an important question. I don't think it's fair to call it kitchen sink. I mean, I think it all ties together. Of course, there's a room for, and every political system needs, a debate about how much government to have and how much redistribution to do. And that's a debate that I think the United States used to have. I mean, probably by the 1970s, the Republican Party, you know, in the 1950s, the parties were not so ideologically distinct at all, really. So, you know, there were obviously, because of the century long unusual history of political parties in the United States, because the White South was overwhelmingly Democratic, but the Democratic Party was not clearly ideologically differentiated. Many political scientists, as you know, were actually concerned about this. They wanted parties that were ideologically differentiated, and then we got that with a vengeance. Of course, there's a room for disagreement in the political spectrum about how high taxes should be, how generous the social safety net should be, how much regulation of business there should be. It turns out right now that the agenda of the Republican Party, as orchestrated by someone like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, consists of policies that are not favored by anything like a majority of the American population. So substantial majorities of Americans want to acknowledge climate change and do something about it. Substantial majorities of Americans think you should have a $15 minimum wage. They think that you should have more taxes for the wealthy. The only way for that neo-Ayn Randian agenda to be enacted is by combining it with a politics of racial resentment, conservative religious concern about growing secularization, because if you don't have that, you don't have majorities that will support your agenda. Now, what's authoritarian is the willingness of the Republican Party. And I just, you know, to me, I don't even know how this is contestable. The stuff in parts 1B and 1C of the paper, the Republican Party is suppressing votes everywhere they have power. And they're doing that on the pretense of voter fraud, which we know essentially does not exist. They're stealing power from Democratic governors once Democrats take control of governorships. They're packing the courts in states like Arizona and Georgia. They tried to do it in North Carolina. The governor said he would do it in Florida if he was succeeded by a Democratic governor. And you know, what is authoritarian is the president attacking the press, the president attacking independent judges. The president did something that if Barack Obama had done, every Republican in Congress would have called for his head, which is he called for a foreign leader to interfere with American democracy on the threat of withholding $400 million in military funds. The president systematically obstructed the Mueller investigation, and not a single Republican in Congress, except for Justin Amash, who had to leave the party, thought that that was a problem and maybe would justify his impeachment. You know, that is an authoritarian party backing an authoritarian president. And the only reason why that is happening, I think, is because the Republican Party, which is now basically owned by the Koch brothers and other conservative billionaires, have an agenda which is so unpopular that they need to combine it with, you know, that's why the Republican Party moved in that direction, I think, because if they didn't, there wouldn't be enough voters out there. And it's, I mean, it's, I don't know if, David, I don't know if you want to have a debate about this. I gave this kind of talk to Harvard alumni in the West, and there were several Trump supporters in the group, and they said, well, how can you call him a racist? How can you, I mean, does racism have a meaning if you don't think he's a racist? I don't know if you want to have a discussion about that. That's not necessarily authoritarian, but it turns out that most authoritarians also play up the threat of somebody. So if it's India, then it's Muslims. And if it's in Hungary and Poland, it's some combination of Muslims and now gays and lesbians in Poland. And if it's Trump, it's some combination of Mexican rapists and murderers and Muslim terrorists. And I don't know what else. So I mean, no, of course there's a room for a conservative politics. I don't agree with it, but I don't think it's necessarily authoritarian. That's just the form it has taken in the United States. And, you know, these people should be ashamed of themselves. What they're doing is reprehensible. It's not reprehensible to be in favor of a more libertarian politics. It's reprehensible to sell your soul to a racist, pathologically lying, misogynistic, Islamophobic, xenophobic, autocratic wannabe.
But other than that, you liked him, so it's fine.
I just don't know what in that is controversial. I mean, it's true. I cannot understand the mindset. I don't know anybody who thinks that Trump did a good job as president. And maybe that tells you something that's a problem about my circle of followers, but even the conservative colleagues I have are enough aware of what's going on in the world and not so delusional and not so willing to buy alternative facts that they understand that Trump is a threat, right? I mean, I have colleagues, including my dean and Jack Goldsmith, who have been Republican voters most of their lives, and they don't support authoritarianism, and they knew enough to leave the Republican Party when my brother was the largest Republican funder in New England, you know, in 2012, largely because of the accident of wanting to support Republicans who supported gay marriage. But he's a thinking, you know, reasonable person who I remember emailed me in the winter of 2015 and 2016 and said, well, if they nominate Trump or they nominate Cruz, I may have to vote for Hillary. And now he's just, you know, he can't believe he was never a Republican. He was an independent. He can't believe what happened to the Republican Party. But 47% of Americans believe that. Right. They've, you know, hook, line and sinker. They've fallen for this. That is a terribly frightening scenario.
All right. So Mike has not had the privilege of reading your response yet. I have. It's entitled Demands for a Democratic Political Economy. I wonder if you would, you know, say whatever you want, but it'd be really interesting, not just for you to focus on kind of what we should do now, but whether you also are broadly on board with Mike's kind of diagnosis and framing of kind of how we got here, what the problem is, such that you're proposing some really exciting solutions.
Yeah. I mean, let me start by saying, I mean, Mike, you just said, you know, some stuff about Donald Trump and said you thought it was incontrovertible. And I agree with you, and yet I think it's an extraordinary feat to have, you know, a 250-page Harvard Law Review foreword making that argument in long form. And so I'm a big fan of the foreword, and I spent considerable time explaining why I think it marks a really important moment in legal scholarship for the foreword to kind of, you know, in some fundamental ways, take on the aesthetics and form of critical legal scholarship. I mean, through the course of the 250 pages, you know, Mike engages law as politics. He takes race and class seriously. He acknowledges the way that legal, political, and social struggle take place in dialectic between various and competing and dynamic social forces. He reminds us in all sorts of various ways that you know, there's no linear progress narrative. And so I'm a big fan of this piece. I learned a lot. I loved reading it. I think it's a really important moment in time and marks that. And hopefully, you know, we'll kind of provide a kind of model for scholars across the liberal left spectrum of how to think about, you know, our role and the questions that we're allowed to ask and the answers we're allowed to explore, because I think the ambition of the piece is also distinct in a way from most forms of law review articles. And that's really important because the questions of our time, whether it's the question of democracy or environmental destruction or police violence, are really massive, large questions. And the way that we've conventionally thought of them are fairly narrow. And it seems important to kind of embrace the depth and breadth and historical nature of the crises that face us. So in terms of, I loved the piece. And I think one of the great things about that is then it kind of allowed me to explore, ways to kind of deepen, expand, or slightly challenge what Mike is writing about or how he's thinking about it. So at some point in the piece, he talks about the relationship between, lack of democracy in the United States and economic inequality, and says, there's a dialectic relationship between increasing economic inequality and increasing lack of democracy. And so the more economic equality we might be able to achieve, the more democracy we can achieve. But then he puts democracy as, that we should, we need to fight first for democracy, which in throughout the piece he defines as, a state where there's some form of popular governance. Then he focuses in on electoral reform as the program for democracy enhancement. And as we've talked about, there's a range of things he talks about, from ending felon disenfranchisement to abolishing the Electoral College, and automatic registration at 18 and more. And all of those reforms, I think, are important. And I think we should talk about them. And I'm on board with most of them. But where I kind of, part or take some disagreement is this, is one, I think, like Sam's question was suggesting, I think Democrats are let off a little too easy. Mike targets his call for reforms as a program for the Democratic Party. And as much as I think the Democratic Party is interested in, maintaining some hold on power and the seats that it has across our three branches of government, I don't think the Democratic Party is going to be the solution for elite rule, because they are part of the problem of elite rule. Not to mention, as I explain in my response, I think elite rule, as Mike talks about, is a much deeper issue than a question of political authoritarianism or failed process. And so elite rule, as we are seeing right now in the context of the coronavirus, means millions of people who are hungry, who are without work, who can't pay rent. It has led to the destruction of the environment in ways that are we're seeing in the fires on the West Coast and the storms on the Gulf Coast. And so we are facing many, many intersecting political, economic, social crises that are a product of elite rule. And so as much as I think we should focus on how to create more space for democracy, I think we have to pay attention to what's happening in the grassroots. And I think we have to think about what kinds of programs, respond directly to economic inequality and the various kind of intersecting crises of hunger, work, education, policing, and so on. And so in the paper, what I do is I look at what are the demands coming out of the grassroots over the course of the last year and really the last 10 years since Occupy, and the increasing radicalization of those demands. I start the piece with a number of like radical demands, like abolish the police and prisons, land back, cancel rent, and so on and so forth. And so the way that in these grassroots mobilizations and organizations and social movements, people are talking about these demands and promulgating all sorts of local campaigns and policy platforms is through this framework of the non-reformist reform, which is a framework that was initially developed in the 60s by a French socialist, André Gorz, but has kind of come back in the last decade, in particular, one, through abolitionist organizing against the prison industrial complex, and two, through the Democratic Socialists of America, where organizers and social movements are thinking about what kinds of reforms can we advance that both kind of advance a radical critique of the prevailing system. And depending on what your political project is, the system of relevance will be different, right? So it might be capitalism, it might be mass criminalization or the prison industrial complex, but looking for reforms that advance radical critique and that advance radical imagination, right? So not based on the logic of what's possible under capitalism or a society of mass criminalization, and then advancing a logic that's radically different, right? So you hear people over profit or provision over punishment, those kinds of things. But then it's not just about kind of like what's the policy fix. It's also, and this is why the grassroots piece is really important. It's centrally important for the conception of the non-reformist reform are reforms that kind of come from the grassroots and build more space for democratic or grassroots power, that they undermine, you know, again, depending on the formulation, undermine the power of capital, build the power of people. And then finally, it's kind of like this question of how do you kind of think about reform projects that allow both to happen, that both build grassroots democratic power, advance radical critique and radical possibility. And so then in the second half of the paper, I talk about defund the police as a non-reformist reform and look at the whole range of demands coming out of grassroots social movements, defund the police, land back, Green New Deal, that, and to say that not only are movements today kind of trying to think about a left program of reform, of non-reformist reforms, but the program specifically is taking a specific shape on you know, people demanding a say on how our collective wealth and our tax dollars are spent, that the, you know, the public has an entitlement to land itself and the shape of our cities. And so when people are saying, you know, no new jails or close this jail, defund the police, build schools infrastructure, that, you know, those are the particular shape of non-reformist reforms today in a way that are interesting and important. And I think, I guess the last thing I'll say, just responding to the last part of what Mike was saying, is in some sense, I think there's a question of, you know, what are the parties offering in terms of the collective project that they're inviting people to join into, if anything? And I think as much as I agree with a lot of what Mike said in terms of indicting all of the people who voted for Trump, I also think there's a question of, you know, kind of what is the alternative that the Democrats are offering and how that fits into the mix.
So I want to ask you the same question I asked Mike. Do the election results bolster or undermine kind of the perspective you're laying out? You know, from a couple of different perspectives, you know, as Mike is emphasizing, an extraordinary number of people voted for Donald Trump in spite of 4 years of delegitimation. You know, no one on the Harvard Law faculty likes Donald Trump, but, you know, more than, you know, 65 million people, okay, possibly one, Adrian Vermeule. But it's just extraordinary that he made gains. He made gains among minority voters. And this is not something that I think one would know based on what you just said. Furthermore, there's the debate that Mike did reference that you're already seeing from kind of centrist legislators and commentators like Damon Linker that, like, not to put too fine a point on it, the loss of the Senate is your fault. You know, had we not had these movements like defund become so prominent in the last year, the Democrats would have had more of a policy space than they do. So, you know, I agree with you totally about the need for grassroots, not just party politics. But, you know, Mike's a great scholar of backlash and other things. You know, are we in a situation where we can make mistakes, not just kind of enjoy success? And what do you make of the election returns, and do they trouble you?
Yeah, I mean, yes, they trouble me.
They trouble your framework.
Right. Okay. Right. They trouble me in the way that Mike said. They trouble me in the ways that you just gestured at, in terms of you know, the numbers of people of color that voted for Trump. I guess I'll say I'm still thinking about this. I think this is a really hard question. I think all the hot takes on the election are great and I welcome them. And I'm sure I've tweeted some myself, but I also think, you know, this is going to take some time to kind of unpack and think about. I will say that one of the reasons why these movement demands feel important to me in a way that's different than 5 or 10 years ago, and certainly 15 or 20 years ago, and why this election felt different, is precisely that we're seeing increasingly large kind of left organization in terms of thinking about questions of power, policy, and governance in a way that we weren't seeing until pretty recently. And so, across the country, whether you're talking about Arizona or Pennsylvania or Michigan, you had many groups who are demanding these non-reformist reforms engage in organized get out the vote campaigns, in connecting kind of like their grassroots organizing with registering voters and making sure that people are voting and so on and so forth. And so I think, you know, Jane McAlevey has written about this in ways that are really powerful, about how, when we separate projects of registering voters or electoral projects from deep grassroots organizing, then basically, you know, you kind of, you're not building capacity for kind of building the kind of power, the kinds of political shifts that would lead to responding to all the economic inequality or racial resentment that Mike talks about so powerfully in the foreword. And so it has to be that we think about how to combine both holding the parties accountable to a more redistributive agenda, and that we engage in grassroots projects at the local level that kind of allow for, broader cross sections of the public to engage in collective projects and political work.
So I want to ask you a kind of follow up to that, which is the relationship between deep participation, democracy, and left political outcomes, because you seem to track a story that's like, very left political outcomes are good. More democracy will lead to left political outcomes, and greater participation will lead to more democracy and therefore a greater political outcome. And none of those things seem in any way obvious to me. So to start, many of the things you talk about are deeply unpopular, right? So they're unpopular. And things that have won. So like, say you talk about the Amazon HQ2 in New York. Well, polling said that was really quite popular, and then it was defeated in a low participation, high engagement, low participation type of politics. Similarly, many of the successes of the things you kind of talk about are premised on the low information, low mass participation world of local politics, something I spent a lot of time studying. One of the things that's notable is that we don't have a mass politics inside cities outside of some mayoral races. You know, turnout in primaries and city council races is half of one, but, you know, it's extremely small. And there's no obvious connection between this type of organizing and genuine popularity. So where it's successful, it's not necessarily democratic in the sense of would have won an up-down vote. And then finally, you see that participation itself is often quite biased against these things. So more participation can lead to non-left outcomes as well as it can lead to left outcomes. So I live my life in housing politics. Well, as Kate Einstein and others have shown, like actually increasing participation, the people who show up at community board meetings are the people most like are homeowners and the ones most likely to participate. Finally, you've seen, if you wanted to like tie it to this election, like left outcomes, like really left, like where we've seen them among polities defined by their theoretical liberalism are, you know, just not that popular. So like rent control lost in a big referendum. There was the whatever the Uber thing was in California. So I just wonder like how you make these links, because again, it like operates internally entirely coherently, which is that if you assume these things are popular but are or should be popular but are defeated by the failure to organize, and that then they are both, there's participation, there's democracy, and there's outcomes, and that they're good. But if you don't accept those chains, none of the chains made too much sense to me. So maybe you could fill me in on like why I should, like, particularly for anyone who doesn't buy any one of those claims. Like, is there something there, or do you need all steps?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I don't think I claim anywhere in the article that the demands that I'm articulating as coming out of today's grassroots movements have mass popular appeal. I'm articulating that these demands are important for a number of reasons, including that they're coming out of, you know, attempts to organize local communities and social movements, and in relation to mass, you know, protest in the way that, for example, happened this summer, and that these issues are issues that clearly move a lot of people. I also, you know, I was thinking about these issues obviously before I read Mike's piece, but part of the reason why Mike's piece provoked me to write this article, which is a book project that I, you know, is not completely digested and kind of gave me an opportunity to start thinking about it more deeply, is precisely because of, you know, it forced me to look at Page and Gillens more closely and all of the different, you know, kinds of issues that Mike talks about in terms of healthcare, minimum wage, climate change, more taxing, where we have kind of, where we do have mass popular appeal, and yet we don't get those policies enacted in Congress. And so I think there's something there that, you know, between the stuff that Mike is talking about, the stuff that I'm talking about suggests, you know, the kind of possibility of a more mainstream politic that comes out of the dialectic of, like, you know, even since the election, I think there have been exit polls on Fox News, or you can think about Bernie Sanders' town hall during the primaries that show, you know, it's not just Democratic voters that support these things. It includes Republican voters across the political spectrum. And so on the one hand, you know, the formation and the politics of each of these parties, Democrat and Republican, you know, I think there is a kind of stranglehold, and there's a way in which Mike talks about in the piece in terms of how racial resentment has led more and more white voters of a certain sort to the Republican Party, suggests a kind of static kind of picture that we can't get out of. And yet there's a way in which the contradiction, but there's a contradiction between that and the mass popularity of things like minimum wage, climate change, regulation, more taxes, and so on, that I think there's, and then when you think about, you know, these town halls and these exit polls, that I think there's a way in which, you know, to kind of rethink these political questions and how they fit into party politics that could reconfigure the terrain of U.S. politics.
But all of those things are kind of normie Democrat things. The ones that are popular, like the minimum wage is supported by literally all Democrats, right? Like, it's like one of those things that's not a, I mean, there's mass support for it, but it's not anything that comes from a, like, a, you don't need to recourse to grassroots politics. Like, the conservative Democrats who are saying don't be too left support the minimum wage also. So I'm just a little unclear about.
Yeah, but a lot of my understanding is a lot of the organizing around, for example, $15 minimum wage comes out of, for example, Fight for 15 or Democratic Socialists of America. And similarly, same with some of these decriminalization measures. And so I'm not suggesting, I mean, I think, you know, like, obviously, there are broad kind of coalitions that are pushing these measures, and then the coalitions shift, change depending on the moment, depending on the place, depending on what the demand is. But I think there's a healthy and important relationship between these radical demands and some of the kind of issues that Mike talks about that have majority kind of hold. But that's not to say, I don't mean to suggest I'm not giving up on, like, these radical non-reformist reforms. I think they're really, really important. And I think, sure, like, lots of people won't agree with me. I mean, I think one of the, another important thing about the Forward, in a sense, and this is what I meant about the importance of Mike going after Trump and the Republicans, is it kind of allows for a space to acknowledge that, you know, we as legal scholars are also not apolitical, and that we have political views and we have concepts of, you know, what democracy means or what law should be about or what the purpose of the state is that can figure. And so, of course, I have a certain kind of political orientation that feeds what I find interesting. It informs my analysis of the world. It, you know, shapes what I think is important. But I think these grassroots movements and organizing, they are not at mass scale, but I think that they represent, you know, a kind of tension point, a kind of place of resistance and friction of organizing by, you know, communities of color, by low-income people, by working class and poor people, formerly incarcerated people, and so on, and elites, right? Like, I'm not trying to say, you know, kind of over-idealize who's participating in this. I think there are diverse constituencies in ways that I think are unprecedented in my lifetime, and I think are really important and are important part of the mix of kind of the you know, both the polarization and the kind of, you know, we both have like increasing rightward drift and increasing leftward drift. And I think to think about only the rightward drift without thinking about the leftward drift is, you know, we have to think about both, because I think both are coming out of, you know, this increasing growing mass sense that the state is failing most people.
So that's a great point of transition to a last question for our podcast. It's for Mike, and it really goes back to the fact that the genre in that you entered is, you know, formally about the Supreme Court. It's about Supreme Court jurisprudence, whether in the last year or in your case, kind of for decades, where you provide a quite devastating portrait of some of the court's work in the voting rights areas, other areas. And yet now we have a picture where the presidency has changed hands. The Senate has not. It's pretty evenly divided. It will provide a lot of blocking to what, as you say, Biden might or might not otherwise have done. But we also know that Mitch McConnell's has, you know, succeeded and not only not lost the Senate, but probably immunize the institutional form of the Supreme Court from the kind of call for change that you issue at the end of the piece, you know, court packing. So I guess in that context, while I totally agree with what you earlier said, that it's like an empirical question in different, you know, times and places, whether courts are majoritarian or not, it seems like that's the counter-majoritarian branch now. And it's one that seems like for a while is going to be pretty immune from pressure, precisely because it's clear that Trump did so well that the court has no reason to kind of wilt in response to the kind of, you know, pressure that occurred in the 1930s. So can you just spell out what we're going to be living through in the future in the face of a non-reformed but, you know, reactionary Supreme Court, given what you say its trajectory has been lately?
Yeah, great. So I had written a piece last weekend for The Atlantic trying to make the strongest case for expanding the court that I could and explaining why it needed to happen now. And you couldn't wait to see whether the court overreached. Obviously, I'm not going to publish that piece, although it looks like there'll be two runoffs in Georgia. And it's not inconceivable, since I believe that one lesson from this election is that people voted for Trump. With Trump not on the ballot and with Trump likely to be on his way out of the White House, I don't think it's inconceivable Democrats could win both of those Senate races. But I mean, it's going to be incredible, right? There are going to be hundreds.
Very unlikely, but conceivable.
There are going to be hundreds of millions of dollars spent on both sides. They're likely to break in the same direction. I have some, Democrats may have won Georgia, right? It's more likely than not they won Georgia. It's true that Democratic voters don't turn out as well in Senate in off-year, off-cycle elections. But it's also true that Trump managed to energize people who, you know, working class whites who are not the most likely voters turned out in huge numbers for him. And they may not show up on whatever January 6th or whatever the election date is. Plus the African-American community in Georgia, which is 30-32% of the voters. It's a good thing that Reverend Warnock is one of the candidates, because I think that will guarantee that there's pretty high Black turnout. But in any event, leave that to one side. Democrats should never forget the court's performance leading up to the election. So the Republican justices, including the Chief Justice, who is willing sometimes to vote strategically with the liberals, their position in the Wisconsin case, based on this Purcell principle, which was never a principle, it was just an offhand statement, but concede the legitimacy and the rationality to the idea that you don't change election rules right before the election. Any rule is subject to exceptions under unusual circumstances. This is a once in a century public health crisis. And you would think you might want to change some of the rules when more people are voting by absentee ballot than ever in the history of an American election. The second problem with the Purcell rule, and I'll get back to the thrust of the question. I'm sorry, this is just a little bit of a tangent. If you read the opinions in the Wisconsin case, there is no acknowledgement, zero in any of them, that what's going on is not a legislature neutrally weighing the costs and benefits of departing from rules under extraordinary circumstances, but rather what we saw everywhere in the country, which is Republicans taking every conceivable measure to reduce turnout and Democrats trying to expand it. So the conservative justices said, okay, that's fine. If the Republican governor of Texas wants one drop-off box for absentee votes in Harris County, which has 5 million people and is the size of Rhode Island, we're just going to assume that the Republican governor is neutrally calculating the costs and benefits of having more drop-off boxes, which, you know, it's just absolutely absurd. And nobody should ever forget that the Republican justices went along with this suppression. It won't matter and people will forget it because Biden's going to win the election and he's going to win it by enough that suppressing a few tens of thousands of votes in one place or another isn't going to matter. All right, now the larger point. Democrats will have a decent chance of taking control of the Senate in 2022, whether or not they pick up these Georgia seats, which I agree, it's probably less likely that they will. Democrats will have a good chance in Pennsylvania, where Republican Toomey has said he's not running for re-election. Democrats will have a pretty good chance in Wisconsin, where the genuinely vile Senator Johnson is going to get a challenger, and I think it's going to be a pretty powerful challenger. Democrats will have another chance in North Carolina, and it looks like they, at the end, will only have lost that seat by maybe a point and a half when all the votes are counted. And there'll be another chance in Georgia because the winner of the special election will have to defend themselves. I don't count any Democratic senators being at risk, except maybe in New Hampshire. That could very well be, and this is the main point, that could be very well the last chance Democrats have seriously of winning the Senate in our lifetime. So the demographic projections are in 20 years, 70% of the population will live in 15 states. That means 30% will pick 70% of the Senate. And given the strong correlation between sparse population density, low population density, and Republican values, Republican voting, Democrats will never have a fair shot at the Senate. There are other ways to see this. So in 2016, Trump lost the popular vote by 2 points, but he won the popular vote in 30 states. And every state essentially voted the same way for the Senate that they did for the presidency. One lesson to take from this election is, other than Maine, there are essentially no ticket splitters anymore. You saw this in New Hampshire in 2016, where the presidency and the Senate race went the same direction, both by like 1,000, 5,000 votes. You just saw it in North Carolina, where Trump may end up winning the state by less than a percentage point until this will be reelected by between 1 and 2 points. I think you're going to see it in Georgia, where Trump looks like he will lose the state and Ossoff will end up have lost his Democratic Senate race by less than 2 points. Even saw it in Arizona, where Mark Kelly ended up, despite the polls, only winning by about 4 points. You're going to see it in Colorado, where the Senate race is going to be 9 or 10 points, and that'll be the presidential race. So Democrats may very well have no more chances to win the Senate if they don't win it in 2022, and then obviously what they need to do, and they could lose the House that year, what they need to do is they need to admit new states, because you're never going to get the Senate change, the Senate malapportionment fixed, and they need to take control of the Supreme Court. What Sam said, I totally agree with you. This is the most conservative court in 100 years for a country that is now center left and is probably trending left based on the fact that Biden's going to end up winning by 4 or 5 points. It's a country that's trending left. And the Supreme Court will have free reign unless Democrats get control of the national government for a brief period of time in which they can entrench democracy, create new states, and expand the size of the Supreme Court. Because if they don't do that, the Supreme Court can strike down every Democratic reform legislation they want. And if you think that can't happen, just look at 5 votes to strike down the ACA under the Commerce Clause, which was an absolutely absurd argument that nobody thought of until Randy Barnett invented it after the law had passed. Or think about Bush versus Gore, which is the most ridiculous constitutional ruling in history. And yet you just saw in the last couple of weeks, several Republican justices invoking the Article II rationale, which is just absolutely absurd. So yeah, this is the Supreme Court. It's open season, except to the extent that Chief Justice Roberts and maybe another justice, maybe Kavanaugh, can sort of see the threat in the background, which would have been in the foreground if Democrats had taken control of the national government. I think they'll be strategic. They will not overplay their hand on the chance that Democrats might have full control of the government after in 2022. But if they voted their ideological preferences, you know, all this stuff would be unconstitutional. Wealth taxes, expanding health care, probably environmental regulation, any kind of reform, and certainly expanding, entrenching democracy at the federal level, they'd strike all that down on federalism grounds.
You know, ironically, the temperature around the court reform debate may go down simply in virtue of the fact that, you know, the Democrats won't be able to pass any new legislation. So there's only old legislation to reinterpret. I mean, you know, maybe new constitutional challenges, but maybe not. And so I agree with you. We're totally waiting for some big discontinuity. But this has been an amazing discussion. We've covered so much. I mean, we could spend years pondering the situation, but you know, we're so grateful, Mike, with your epic forward, that you came on to talk with us about it, and Amna with your fantastic response that you weighed into. So thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for having us.